Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I am the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. This is our 104th episode, and it's titled Looking Inward, Can We Win, or Will We Defeat Ourselves? This episode is a bit unusual for Revolution Z, not so much in its topic, matters of strategy, but in the extent to which it is about matters of individual psychology, I guess one might say, even though they sum up to collective relevance. It is based on an article I did not too long ago, but it seeks to go further than the article, at least in some respects. So let's begin. Looking inward, can we win, or will we defeat ourselves? By win, I mean win it all, not win a little. Win a new world. Win new defining social institutions. Win an end to injustice, inequality, domination, and subordination. Win an end to class, gender, sex, race, and all hierarchies that raise some people to be above and reduce other people to be below. Win equity, win solidarity, win diversity, win self-management. Win today's kids, or at worst their kids, to become wholly and totally free at last. In other words, win a new world, win what we say we seek. Turn aspiration into actuality. Make words, slogans, and demands not mere rhetoric, but new reality. Geez, you may think, is he serious? Is this a sermon or a podcast? Familiar skepticism fuels feelings that to talk about winning everything sounds, well, odd. Such skepticism comes in many forms. For example, familiar skepticism about such profound progress often reflects a fear that status quo relations have grown too strong to overcome. I think such fear is false. We can fight and we can defeat City Hall. The powers that be are far from unconquerable. Their might is greatly overestimated. Their vulnerability to serious, informed, highly organized, mass opposition is greatly underestimated. But amassing serious, informed, highly organized opposition is the real hurdle we have yet to jump. Jump that, and winning change will no longer look out of reach. But that is not what I want to discuss today. A second basis for doubt is both more widespread and more entrenched than the idea that the powers that be are simply too powerful. And in these horrible times, this second basis for doubt is on the rise, even rampant and almost viral. I refer to the idea, the compliant, nagging concern, or the deep belief, whichever it may be for you, that there is something about how humans are wired, something about our deepest natures, and derivatively, something about who we can and cannot be that stands between us and liberation. This is the idea that biology decrees that there is no alternative. One form that this fear takes is the notion that humans are intrinsically greedy, selfish, individualistic, antisocial creatures who cannot collectively be socially civilized. In that form, this fear believes that in a much better world, inborn human depravity would reimpose depraved social relations. In other words, if we were to overcome the powers that be, so what? We would, even against our own rhetoric and interests, but in tune with our inner natures, reimpose greed, extreme individualism, antisociality, and all the vile manifestations of each in our new world, just like the old world. But if human nature was that self-denying and antisocial, all life would be self-denying and antisocial. There would be no sympathetic, socially caring dimension, no goodness. The point is, what is intrinsically in our natures in the way that this fear intimates that greedy antisociality is in our natures, not just as a potential, but as who we are, would be ever-present. Antisociality would be ever-present like having a liver needing oxygen, seeing as we see, hearing as we hear, and having communicative capacities are ever-present. Wired in greed, wired in selfish individualism, and wired in antisociality would be always actual. Like we have two eyes, we would have greed. Like we have no third eye, we would never exhibit social solidarity. It seems obvious to me, in other words, and it has been discussed in various other Revolution Z episodes, that it is far more reasonable and even demonstrable that the ill that afflicts human societies is imposed by fixtures and forces that derive from our institutions, rather than that the ill is imposed by intrinsic, ugly, underlying natures. We can be greedy, clearly. Hell, humans can be serial killers, by our own hands or by drones and missiles. True. But is greed or mass murder commonplace because it automatically bubbles up from our internal wiring, like our needing oxygen bubbles up from our genetics? Or is it commonplace because it is imposed by the economic and social structures we have so long lived within that push and pull us and that we have to abide if we are to even survive our contextual situations at all? Put differently, does our DNA compel us to amass fortunes or to endure poverty? Does our DNA ensure that some are born to rule and others are born to be ruled? Does our DNA produce war and want? Or do the institutions all around us propel and even enforce the ugly outcomes against our best potentials? Here is still another way to approach the issue. If instead of capitalist, racist, sexist, social relations all around us, suppose our surroundings become conducive of and even require empathy and equity, would our natures then rebel against our surroundings because our natures intrinsically crave antisociality and inequity? If not, which I certainly think is the case, how do we combat the widespread, stultifying belief that just relations are beyond our reach due to who we are? I would suggest that we have to learn to describe just relations. We have to learn to show, including by planting and nurturing their seeds in the present, that in their presence we would freely be the best we can be. And we have to make evident just how socially desirable that would wind up. The pessimistic and debilitating view certainly exists. Indeed, it perpetually bolsters the status quo and is nurtured and echoed by those who stand atop the status quo. Worse, it is even nurtured and bolstered by many who suffer beneath the status quo. The pessimism deserves constant challenge, and that has been and remains a big part of what Revolution Z tries to do by offering positive vision and trying to convey its logic and ethics, its viability, and its worthiness. But that, too, is not what I have in mind to focus on this episode of Revolution Z. No, what troubles me, what I want to focus on for the rest of this episode, is a somewhat different, albeit related, fear that humans are forever doomed to suffer rather than to celebrate each other due to our psychologies. A fear that I suspect is now rising among folks who are otherwise largely immune to such doubts, rising among folks who are otherwise oriented to win changes and certainly not to accept, much less to trumpet, its impossibility. I think that additional type of fear of failure goes something like this. People aren't bad to the bone. No, people living amidst institutions fostering collective fulfillment and mutual aid would not perversely seek collective insecurity, mutual hostility, and even barbarity. A vastly better world is thus biologically conceivable. Rather, the problem is that we people have an almost infinite capacity, inclination, and even drive to protect our own self-conceptions. And the problem is that that defensive trait, though it would make people fine with maintaining good relations if we could ever attain good relations, sadly, given our long social and personal pasts and our restricted presence, often orients people to suicidally maintain our own subjugation, a condition which is then further aggravated by the intense individualism our social context produces in us. Metaphorically, we go down rabbit holes, and my apologies to rabbits if the formulation is unfair to them. And in our holes, we rationalize our past choices to protect our derivative current self-conceptions. We double down on our own past, even on our incredibly pained past, and in doing so, we disconnect ourselves from openness and from change that is essential to attain a better future. We have, in other words, an almost infinite inclination to protect our own self-conceptions, and when we abide that inclination, after having operated in horribly restricted and alienated contexts, we all too often impose on ourselves huge volumes of defensive baggage. More, we not only carry that baggage, but we even cling tightly to it, as if it was a life jacket, protecting us rather than a chain dragging us down. We lie, and then we lie to support the first lie, then again, and soon we are liars to ourselves and to others. We adopt a view, typically in very restrictive settings, and despite if we were wrong, in fact, all the more so to avoid admitting that we were wrong, we defend the view. We see this pattern of aggressive self-defense, even self-elevation, in others far more easily than we see it in ourselves, unless, of course, their rabbit hole is held together with the same rationalizations as ours, mutually enforced self-delusions. In that case, that is, since we share compatible rationalizations, we all dwell together, maybe 10 of us, maybe 10 million of us, like a tribe of burrowed rabbits. As one source of this type development, families often breed lots of early life friction and ensuing callousness or dismissiveness, or just plain pain. That, in turn, breeds lots of self-deception to preserve self-perception. It puts some on one side, some on another side, to everyone's detriment. Maybe one side is right and one side is wrong. Probably more often, both sides are somewhat right and somewhat wrong, and the breakdown is itself wrong. Small-scale exile, or even war. The self-deception causes us to slip-side into holes we long inhabit. Separate paths divide family members from one another, and even worse, divide each from our own best selves. We all become freighted with too much baggage. But it isn't just families that generate such trajectories. Our actions at work, even at play, our political choices, looking the other way or diving into one way, our choice for surviving systemic assaults all across our lives can engender the same self-preserving and simultaneously self-limiting processes. Any of these can propel us into the netherworld of self-deceptions that protect our immediate identities at the expense of our near and long-term potentials. We embrace an initially tiny little lie to rationalize some prior choice. The choice persists. The lie grows. The lie becomes monstrous. We cling tighter. When this happens, politically, we self-absorb into a self-protecting or self-elevating story. We start to filter perceptions, even to spin and twist them, to sustain and rationalize and seemingly prove our past correctness. Soon, we sectarianly celebrate demonstratively false premises and patterns as if they are utterly obvious. And indeed, to us, they come to look absolutely utterly obvious. We do this to not acknowledge some past error, to not undercut some past choice we think defines us, which indeed, as we enter and bulwark our rabbit hole, does come to define us, though it need not have. We do this even to the point of self-destruction. The most graphic example I had earlier heard of was Stalin's admirers assembling to hear of their own exile or execution, and then pledging their loyalty to their judge, jury, and executioner, Stalin himself. Just imagine that. These people, established Stalinist party members, were not dumb or unlearned. They did not lack the tools and means to explore the truth. They could be logical. They could bring to bear evidence. They simply lost the ability to do it regarding their long-time rabbit holes. They simply burrowed themselves into their proud postures, into their rabbit holes. Having defended Stalin earlier, they defended him to the end. Wrong from the start, wrong to the end, entwined with one another. They swore allegiance to Stalin. They became Stalinists as their identity. And once having done so, they bent their perceptions to enforce the validity, the morality, and the wisdom of their initial choice. They bent everything to make all criticism of them appear to be ridiculous or malevolent or whatever else could be ridiculed, dismissed, ignored. Okay, you might think, but that was a historical aberration, like the German experience. But the most graphic example I have recently heard about is COVID-19 patients in the Dakotas pledging from their deathbeds their allegiance to Trump and asking how they could be so sick since the virus is a hoax. Just imagine that. Except you don't have to imagine. Variants on it are visible daily, all around us. To the person deep in the throes of this sort of identity-protecting self-delusion, everything they formulate seems to them totally believable fact, not fiction. They succeed in staying their course. Their self-image persists. Hooray for their side. But they also fail. Their prospects for rational progress and for solidarity with others declines. I would bet that most people hearing this edition of Revolution Z are at this point astutely and rather comfortably thinking that I am writing, however carefully, about Trump voters. Well, I could be. But what about Biden voters? What about sect members of whatever persuasion? What about not just sexists, racists, authoritarians, and capitalists, but sometimes even feminists, anti-racists, anti-authoritarians, and anti-capitalists? What about me and mine? Put differently, how does one judge? Am I in a rabbit hole? Am I clinging to a past-protecting fairy tale? Are my absolutely certain feelings about this or that family or daily life conflict, or about this or that political or social conflict, or about this or that idea inhabiting my mind, sober and susceptible to evaluation and change? Or are my absolutely certain feelings or ideas instead fabrications, designed to protect myself from seeing that I have been wrong somewhere in the past and have doubled down on my mistakes ever since, continually digging myself in ever deeper? I doubt there is a definitive answer for how one can judge. But maybe there are some approaches to evaluating oneself and deciding, am I in a rabbit hole, or am I exerting perfectly reasonable realism? In any event, I would like to suggest two straightforward ways to try to assess if we are rabbiting, whether it is regarding our relations to others, or our commitments to beliefs, or ideas, or even whole frameworks of thought. First, we can openly consult people who can't possibly be in the same hole with us, and who would have no reason to deceive us. That is, we ask people who should be able to see and should be willing to report that our behavior or beliefs are rooted more in protective self-delusion than in openly reasoned calculation. And second, perhaps even more indicatively, we can ask ourselves, are we open to the possibility of being wrong? Are we open to the possibility that our sureness rests on subjective defensiveness and not on objective evidence? Have we tried to see ourselves as others who are critical of us say they see us? The idea is that our being open or closed to the possibility that what appears to us to be definitive evidence may itself be our misreading reality and spinning events to justify past choices is a good indicator of our being rabbity or not. But one step further, an even bigger question than identifying what I am calling rabbiting is, what can be done by a relative, friend, workmate, or especially an organizer, to prod, poke, push, or pull someone, or some group, from their own psychically created, inflexible, deluded, rabbity posture, back to realism and flexible evaluations that aren't predetermined by defense of past choices. Having methods to accomplish that matters profoundly, because the tendency to explain our circumstances and choices in ways that avoid any doubt about their efficacy and accuracy often also leads us to rationalize what is our current condition, rather than to surpass our current condition. It leads us to reject and negate whatever seems to suggest, propose, or pursue change. It becomes, in short, a profound self-reinforcing obstacle to solidarity, mutual aid, and collective social victories. Methods to address the rabbity tendency are therefore essential not only to helping someone we may care about, but also to successfully organize people we don't yet know, and to improve ourselves, of course, as well. So the upshot is that we who would improve ourselves, our relatives, our friends, our neighbors, or especially the world, need to learn how to deal with this human inclination. We need to learn to deal not only with its most obvious political forms, like sectarianism, but also with its more personal dimensions that are cumulatively no less deadly to our political and social openness to critical change. That was how the article I earlier wrote ended. And I should like to add here, along with various other changes I added throughout, that I think the above subject matter is more relevant to winning social change than, well, honestly, most of what political writers and sometimes even organizers prioritize as our focus or topic. Why, one might wonder, do we give more attention to berating Trump as compared to trying to calmly understand how the hell he managed to rise so high and make so many changes himself? And still more so, what it has been about our own activist choices, our own rhetoric, our own demands, our own actions that left such large constituencies open to his influence? For that matter, Why do we spend way more time and effort explaining how painful capitalism, racism, or sexism are in our left publications and our left venues, whose readers are certainly well aware of what we are saying, save perhaps in some minuscule, unearthed new detail, than we spend indicating what we want for another world and why it is possible, and how we might best seek to get it? All of which far fewer of our readers are able to convey or are even aware of. It is easy to see, or to think we see, others rabbiting into defensive and even self-deceptive holes. It is harder to see ourselves doing it. Yet to win, personally, and more so collectively, we must see rabbiting wherever it occurs. Finally, if I could, I would like to change gears and take another minute of your time. Revolution Z, along with Park Media, a Midwestern grassroots community organizing and also podcast project, are working to create a new online effort named School for Social and Cultural Change, or SSCC for short. SSCC's first 8-week session is set to start January 1st. Our hope is that over the coming year, SSCC will become a self-sustaining new institution with a steadily growing selection of courses that provide means to explore and share skills, practical lessons, analyses, strategy, and compelling vision. Our hope and expectation is that it will assemble a steadily growing team of instructors and a growing community of participants in courses and perhaps some shared other projects as well. This is in no sense beyond our material and organizational means. The technology is in place, people able to prepare and host courses are plentiful, people who can learn, that is all of us, are still more plentiful. The only high hurdle to SSCC becoming a large, sustained source of skills, analysis, strategy, and vision, discussion, exploration, and sharing is getting started. And to get started, we do need help. The first 4 courses address polity and anarchism with Andrei Grubercheck, cybersecurity with John S., music and politics with Sandy Carter, and my course, Life After Capitalism. To get up and running toward continual growth and development, SSCC mainly needs initial students. It needs people willing to take the plunge on a new effort. I greatly hope Revolution Z listeners will provide source by signing on for one or more courses. You can visit the school to read about courses and instructors, see the facility, and, should you choose to do so, to sign up for a course at sscc.teachable.com. That's sscc.teachable.com. Please take a look. Please help us give SSCC life. And that said, this is Michael Albert signing off until next time for Revolution Z, and hoping to see you online in the new school as soon as you have time to visit, to access the first offerings, and hopefully to sign up for one or another of them. Thanks again.